This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Professor Shibley Talami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. His new book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion, and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Shibley, welcome back to Berkeley.
It's always good to be back here. It feels like home.
And you did your graduate work here.
Absolutely.
So you know your way around the campus.
I still do, and I'm always happy to be back here.
Let's talk about your new book. What was your goal in writing this book?
You know, it's really interesting because in some ways this is a book that, based on a project that's 20 years old and certainly more than 10 years of actual public opinion polling in the Arab world. But as you know, when I studied at Berkeley, I come out of the realist school of thought. I studied with Kenneth Waltz, who sadly passed away recently. And I still am in my own thinking about the world, I still am focused on the distribution of power. I understand that political systems are evaluated in large part based on some distribution of power and the structure of the political system itself, whether it's international politics or domestic politics. So I start with that undoubtedly. But I think one of the things that a lot of scholars have missed in looking at politics, particularly in systems that are more closed, authoritarian systems, particularly in the Middle East, is that even though obviously the distribution of power is favoring smaller parties and obviously in some ways publics don't matter nearly as much, that in almost all of the political system that I have observed in the Middle East, rulers behaved as though public opinion mattered a lot to them, for their legitimacy, for what they do. And yes, there are times when they can disregard the public opinion, do what they want to do at some cost to them. And they have to reframe everything that they do to accommodate the public opinion. It started really after the 1991 Iraq War, when you contrasted the reaction. You had the King of Jordan, who was dependent on the U.S., arguably one of the closest American allies in the Middle East, had a good relationship with Israel, friendly, quietly, but friendly. And here he goes against the U.S. on the Iraq War and gives Saddam Hussein more of an airing on the media, in large part because he thought if he didn't do that, he stood to pay a too heavy a price with his own people. He didn't do it. And yet there were the Saudis, who Saddam Hussein bet they could never allow American troops on their holy soil to attack him. Mm-hmm. They did, and they survived. So there were all these subtleties in the way public opinion was a factor in the calculations, and it wasn't fully understood. So I started really studying that early on. I wrote a couple of articles right after that war. And as the information revolution exploded with the advent of Al Jazeera and satellite television, I thought to myself that the role of public opinion is bound to increase, and the role of the public broadly is bound to increase in politics. And we have a revolution we don't fully understand in the information arena, and we should try to figure out if we can document the change over time. So I basically planned a project of public opinion surveys that would last at least 10 years because we need to study change over time, in which the focus wasn't simply on public opinion, but rather on the information revolution itself and its relationship not only to changing public opinion on core issues in the Arab world, but also on changing notions of identity, how people define themselves and how that is impacted by what was a transnational information arena that took away the monopoly of information from the rulers. So that was basically the vision of the project. And as we got into the 2010-2011, the Arab uprisings that came after a decade of turmoil, We saw that we needed to also understand what happened after the Arab uprising, whether there's a transformation. So continued to do polling until 2012. And this book, in essence, is really an assessment not only of what people think, but what drives their thinking, because the bottom line in understanding public opinion isn't simply to tell their opinion, but really to try to figure out what is the framework through which they make an evaluation. When they say they like someone, when they say they advocate a policy, what is driving their decision? That's really the fascinating part of the story. And you can't divorce that from the basic notion of identity, because I think identity informs opinion far more than the media. We usually think it's the media as the driver. It isn't. The media is more responding than driving opinion.
So you're talking about conducting these studies over a period where the defining feature of the environment has really changed drastically. And so in the beginning, what you had were very repressive environments where you were arguing just now that subtly there was still a responsiveness. And then now we're in a period of activism with drastic change and so on. So how have you had to adjust the way you've asked questions? We know here in the United States that, you know, is what people tell pollsters correct and so on. Your problem is really compounded in that environment.
Well, first of all, particularly in the early days when we didn't even know that we can ask intrusive questions that are political in closed systems. Remember, that included Saudi Arabia and Egypt under Mubarak and Jordan and Morocco, Lebanon, and the United Arab Emirates. So they're very different systems. But we always understood that, number one, don't ever ask a question that is going to make them feel too uncomfortable. For example, never ask the question, how much do you like Mubarak or how much do you like King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia? That's not particularly helpful. What you try to find is indirect indicators. So the best questions are really indirect, that you're trying to get, as I said, at the framework through which they make an evaluation. And you can't just ask one question. You have to ask multiple questions to get at these indicators. One of the questions, for example, that I asked is, name the leader that you admire most in the world outside your own country. I never want them to compare with their own leader. And the idea, of course, is not a popularity contest. It doesn't really matter what they say. You know, one guy might appear one year and disappear the next year. So it's not a popularity contest as such. The idea behind it is that you are trying to figure out what is it that is driving their choice? And so when you evaluate the choices over a period of a decade or so, say, okay, so what is driving their choices? And that indicates to you what's behind their opinion. What are their aspirations? How do they determine their heroes and their villains and so forth? Now, after the Arab uprising, it's fascinating because the one country where we had before and after that is very clear. We had polls in 2009, 2010 before the Egyptian overthrow of Mubarak, and then we had 2011, 2012 polls there two years to compare. And here's the fascinating thing, is here's an environment early on in Egypt which was clearly far more open. You could see it in an incredibly transformed information arena, the media, more open after Mubarak was overthrown. By the way, it's closed since Morsi was overthrown. So it is a huge change in Egypt. But during those 2 years, there was no question there was far more open media and far more relaxed atmosphere of people saying what they want, attacking who they want. And yet, on the sort of questions that we asked, their identity, their attitudes toward big ticket items like the Arab-Israeli issue, war and peace, the role of religion, attitudes toward the United States, attitudes toward global powers, attitudes toward Iran, there was much change. It was very much here, different, completely different arena, and yet their aspirations, the worldviews had not shifted dramatically from before. And you could tell at what the data you're getting is very much comparable to the data you were getting before.
Now, what I want to understand better, why what informed you in basically understanding what to look at? So you were born in the Middle East. You know Arabic. Talk a little about that, because there are sort of two elements here. One is, first, let's talk about that background a little. So you're comfortable with the region.
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, you know, I grew up in a very critical period in the 1950s, born in an Arab village near Haifa in what was right after Israel was established. I grew up inside a village that had multi-ethnicity. We had Muslims, Christians, Druze. And yet we also were in the state of Israel, so we had to learn Hebrew as we went along. And it was unavoidable to deal with the issues of identity. This is something that you struggled with throughout, even at the local level, vis-a-vis the sectarian issue. And, of course, a period in which, you know, we witnessed a lot of conflict, particularly the 67 war, before I came to study in the U.S. So it's an issue that I you know, grew up with, an issue. I was fascinated by politics. I listened to news more than music when I was a kid. It was unavoidable to listen to every possible radio you can get at the time. We can get Egypt's The Voice of the Arabs. We can get Jordanian radio. We can get the BBC in Arabic and Voice of America. We can also get the local Israeli radio. So you had a mix of opinion, limited, mostly radio, obviously, not television. But yes, it's an issue, of course, that I grew up with. These are issues I've grappled with at the personal level. But later on, obviously, I grappled with much more intellectually and as a scholar. And over the years, I mean, prior public opinion polls were a side issue for me because I had studied the region without public opinion polls for decades before. I mean, throughout, I started, you know, in the 1970s, when I started late 1970s, I started graduate school, spent considerable amount of time in Arab countries, particularly Egypt, but elsewhere from the Gulf region to Syria, Lebanon, North Africa, and certainly Israel and the Palestinian territories. I had a sense of it. I'm a participant in that media. I participate in the Arab media. I appear on Al Jazeera Arabic. I read the Arabic press. I talk to people. Mm-hmm. So my sense of what's important is based on analysis broader than the public opinion. The public opinion is an instrument to try to get at deeper issues, number one, and two, how pervasive the views that are you capturing at the elite level or in interviews or communications or media, how pervasive they are. We didn't know for sure because, you know, I remember when I, in 1990 specifically, just before Iraq invaded Kuwait, I had been a Council on Foreign Relations fellow assigned to Congressman Lee Hamilton as his advisor on the Middle East. I went to the Middle East and in order to write a report on the consequences of the end of the Cold War for the Arab world. I wrote a report about Arab public opinion as I read it after talking, you know, going to multiple countries. And I, you know, could identify deep anti-Americanism expressed mostly over the Israel-Palestine question. And you could map it out in every meeting I had, you know, whether it's politicians, journalists, academics, people I meet in coffee shops. That was true. But was that really public opinion? Was that just elite public opinion? How do I know that what I'm capturing is really pervasive? So this gave us a new tool to refine the questions, to try to get more deeply into what's driving the issues, to try to differentiate those opinions that are reflective of core identity and those that are just a function of the discourse around them that is made up in some ways by the media.
Your training formal education here at Berkeley under Ken Walt turned you into an international relation specialist and theorist. And I'm curious how IR theory was another layer in forming your ability to do this analysis.
Well, it's really a great question because it even ties to my very first book that came out of my dissertation on international bargaining, where I was always trying to reconcile, on the one hand, what I understand about the importance of the distribution of power in any international relations game, so to speak. But on the other hand, I understand that foreign policy of states are also impacted by internal dynamics, including public opinion. How do I reconcile the two? That was always an issue for me. But the starting point has never deviated from the fact that I start with distribution of power. And even here in this book, what I say about the Arab uprisings, I say, if you are going to identify what is unique about those sets of uprisings that emerged in 2010 across the Arab world, you would have to say that there is something unique for sure, but it is the empowerment of individuals on a scale that we had never witnessed before, driven by this expanding information revolution. It's not likely to go back. So we have an empowered public. But is the realism, number one, an empowered public doesn't mean a unified public, because you're going to have, you know, multiple publics that are empowered, left and right, rich and poor, secular and religious, sectarian, and that results in conflict. Number two, they're not equally important because it is about the distribution of power in society. Number three, public opinion is never the only factor, even in democracies. And look at witness here, how, you know, we talk about how many Americans don't even participate in elections, how campaign contributions are such a critical point in determining policies on specific issues, how lobbies matter on specific issues. Distribution of power matters even in full democracies. They certainly matter in places like the Arab world, where you have a transitions. And so the military still matter. The rich people still matter. The bureaucracies still matter. Religious organizations still matter. So what you have is a new force that is more powerful than before, that has a voice that has to be heard in the political system. But that doesn't tell you how politics is going to unfold, because you have to weigh that voice, you have to weigh that factor still against that distribution of power that you can't avoid. And that's even in domestic politics. When you take the international game and map it on top of that, for example, when you watch the Arab uprisings unfold and you have to say, what kind of systemic change has that resulted in the short term? Well, you say, well, the voice of Egypt has diminished because they're going through a transition. Syria is out of the game in Arab politics because of the problems it's facing. Iraq is still, you know, not a big factor in Arab politics because of the war it's recovering from. It raises the power of the Saudis and the Gulf states, who are rich and still relatively stable and able to use it. And they start being players in Egypt, offering billions to one faction against the other in the anti-Morsi conflict in Egypt, in Syria, where they are weighing in against Assad. So power matters, whether it's at the how it's distributed internationally or domestically. But you have to now understand this new force of empowerment and take it into account in figuring out how politics will unfold in the coming years.
For an American audience not trained in these issues, there's a lot of confusion about the different battles that have emerged in these places. You identify three. Talk a little about that, the public awakening, the regional conflict, and then the sectarian battle. So help us.
Well, I mean, the best way to understand it really is to look at Syria, because we all are, you know, depressed about what's happening in Syria. I am, because it's very hard to see a short-term way out, and there's so much devastation and tragedy and death and destruction. And initially, it was a hopeful environment because, recall, when the Arab uprising started, the first two seemed to happen relatively peacefully and relatively successfully, Tunisia and Egypt. And so when, you know, the public will seem to meet this military opposition and confrontation, as happened in Syria and Bahrain, a lot of people were obviously sympathetic with the public, seeing it as a popular revolt seeking freedom and dignity against a dictatorship, which in large part it was early on. But what happened, as we know, is that on top of all that, Syria is so complex in the sectarian makeup. That's number one, which is you have a significant Alawi minority that is disproportionately in power in Syria. You have a significant Christian minority that is mostly worried about militant Islam and allies itself with them. You have the Druze minority, which is also sort of takes partially the side of the government, divided. And you have even the Sunnis divided between a mainstream brotherhood and some secular Islamists or pan-Arabist. And so everybody is empowered, and therefore everybody is fighting for their identity, fighting for the shape of the country, fighting for, in some cases, their own survival. Then on top of that, you have an international arena of competition. If you look at that competition, it is a lot of parties obviously involved, including Turkey and Iraq and Lebanon, Israel. Everybody is involved in some way, even not equally. But really the biggest competition is between Saudi Arabia on the one hand and Iran on the other. They're both battling for strategic game in the region, particularly with the decline of Iraq and its shift toward Iran. And with it, there's a Sunni-Shia divide issue where the Saudis are worried about the empowerment of the Shia, and the Iranians are getting the help of Hezbollah, Shiite Hezbollah in Lebanon. So you have this additional layering on top of it. And then on top of all that, there is this issue of the Arab-Israeli conflict that people try to exploit, of saying, well, what are the consequences for that? Who's going to be tougher on Israel? Is it going to be Assad, or is it going to be the opposition? Where does the U.S. come in, given the broad resentment of American foreign policy in the region? So it becomes very difficult to separate these issues when you're looking at Syria.
We are experiencing the Arab awakening, and you say the data indicates that the majority of Arabs in the uprising see the uprising simply as a revolt of ordinary people seeking dignity, freedom, and democracy. That is the common aspiration. Mm-hmm. That's where we begin. You've already discussed, even you as a young person, listening to very primitive media in compared to what's available. So there has been this amazing transition and change in the information revolution that's affecting these actors. But then at the core, and what drew you into your studies, you just said, is this struggle for identity of people. How does that come together? I mean, what for the individual Arab, what are his choices in terms of his identity, and how does he pick and choose between them?
This is, a central question, a central theme, I think, to understand, and it's one that drives much of what I try to do, is try to come to grips with it, in large part because I think Middle East scholars understood that the drive for legitimacy in the Arab world has always been part of the policy calculations of every ruler because of the absence of representative democracy that created a relationship with the state that is close and representative. And so one of the things I tried to understand, particularly on collective identity issues, is understanding that all Arabs, like everybody else, are complex, meaning that you can be an Egyptian and an Arab and a Muslim or a Christian at the same time. We all can, or a citizen of the world, or multiple identities that we all have in some way. But the question was, how were people tilting? What was it that was driving their choices? Which one was more important to them at any given time? Is it Arab? Is it Egyptian? Is it Jordanian? Is it Muslim? So I set up a question along these lines. And what we found was that over the decade preceding the Arab uprisings, we had a declining affinity with the state. People were less likely to identify themselves in a relationship with the state, and an increase in the number of people who identified themselves more as Muslim. And Arab identification remained robust throughout the decade. And so the question is, what drove that and what does it mean? What are the interpretation of that? And I can give you my own explanation, but one of the things I want to make clear is that I think the rise in Islamic identity was most certainly misunderstood to mean an embrace of political Islam, which I think it was not, for sure. Mm-hmm. And the analysis show that it was not, and we have a lot of evidence on that. So what drives that? And I have a theory on this, which says that, you know, essentially a identity selection is driven by two tendencies on two different ends. On the one end, you embrace that aspect of your identity that you have to defend most. You, as someone once said, you are what you have to defend. And on the other, you embrace that aspect of identity that is that you see as most likely to deliver on your aspirations, the vehicle that is most instrumental. So it's those two tendencies that drive your choices as to which one you embrace most. Now, if you look at that whole decade, number one, there was the decline in identification with the state is not surprising at all. Part of it, not all of it, part of it is a reinforcement of a transnational media that emerged. The satellite television created a transnational media environment. For example, if I'd asked people 20 years ago, what is your most important source of news, most people would have likely identified their own state television. By 2010, in all the countries that we polled, when you ask them where they get the what's the most important source of news, they identify a source outside their own country. And that tells you something about the transnational nature, in part because the media, the satellite media, created a bigger Arab market. It wasn't no longer local. And therefore, it had to cater to those things that are in common among Arabs and Muslims to reach the broadest audience, and in the process reinforce transnational identity in some ways. So there's a media reinforcement. It's not the main driver. But the second is that a decline of identification with the state was partly a failure of the states to deliver. I mean, that had been fully recognized about whether it was with jobs or economy or dignity. I want to come back to that a little bit later on. The failure of the state reinforced by the fact that in many places, including take Libya, for example, and Egypt, the overwhelming majority of the citizens didn't know a leader other than their president, in the case of Gaddafi and Mubarak, because they've lasted 30 in the case of Mubarak, 40 over 40 in the case of Gaddafi. And when that's the case, you can't differentiate state from ruler. A ruler is the state. The state is the ruler. And if you're angry with the ruler, you're angry with the state. So there was a decline of the state. The question is, why does Islamist identity rise? Let's say not Arabist identity. And I'll give you two interpretations of that. One interpretation is that you are what you have to defend. We have every evidence to suggest that, particularly after 9/11, most Arabs felt that Islam was under assault in this clash of civilization approach. They felt that American foreign policy was seeking to weaken Muslims. And I think while they, you know, people mean different things when I say I'm a Muslim, sometimes it's political, sometimes it's cultural, sometimes it's religious. But the assertiveness of that identity is in part saying, I don't have to apologize for the fact I'm a Muslim. I don't have to apologize for the fact that Sharia is important to Islam. So it's an assertiveness in part for that dynamic. But the second is that when you look at the whole decade, Pan-Arabists have been on the decline. There was no real visible figure to lead, to give them a sense that this is an effective vehicle. Saddam Hussein had been, had been defeated. Nasser had been long gone. And there were no voices advocating that, particularly in the arena. And most of the forces that have been organizing opposition had been essentially Islamic forces. And so I think it was not an embrace of Islamist ideology, and we see that in the polling. I'll give you two examples of that. One is that in Egypt particularly, in 2012, just before the presidential elections, when we asked people if they wanted Sharia law to be a basis for the constitution, for sure you get a large number saying yes. We get like two-thirds say yes. But when we asked them, do they want Sharia to be implemented literally or to be adapted to modern times, the overwhelming majority, over 80%, say the latter, adapted to modern times. So we have the second example is on Al-Qaeda. A lot of people thought maybe these militant groups like Al-Qaeda were getting support. When we asked them, what aspect of Al-Qaeda do you admire most, if any? Of course, many say none. But number one is the fact that it was standing up to the U.S., the enemy of my enemy. And number two, that it was advocating for causes they could, relate to. Fewer than 10%, in some cases fewer than 6%, said they embraced their ideology of puritanic in Islam. So it wasn't embrace of an agenda. And I think in some ways the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, when it came to power, didn't quite fully grasp the reluctance of people to accept a Islamist ideology as such, even though they were prepared to give them a chance to lead.
You're suggesting that there's an element of helplessness among people who are acquiring these new aspirations, and that this helplessness and there's a diffuse quality about what they can do about what they want, that they then gravitate toward this apparent global struggle where Al-Qaeda, which originally had its basis in national protest, I mean, when thinks of Zawahiri, moves to a global, and then you have the U.S. sort of intervening here and there, the Iraq War, for example, creating a – so in a way, what you're saying is when you break down the opinion and look at it carefully, the conclusions are very different than when you're dealing with this diffuse sentiment with regard to this global confrontation.
Yeah, we have to break down what the sources of opinions are to understand what are the aspirations of the people.
Yeah.
Because now what we're talking about is really what do people aspire to? What is driving them? What do they want? That's really the question, because all of these opinions they express are just measures. Mm-hmm. They're just opinions, and they can change from day to day. So what we need to understand is what's driving them? Who are they? Who do they want to be? What kind of system do they want? What do they aspire to be? And I think what you see, this question becomes more relevant because of this public empowerment of people going to the streets and saying, I'm not going to put up with somebody dictating to me anymore. They want a lot of different things, including stability and security, and that matters, but they want more. And so the question is, what is it that they aspire to? Now, if you look at it throughout the early days of the Arab uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt particularly, but also in Yemen and elsewhere, the term that comes up most is dignity. Now, they want jobs and they want better education. They want freedom. You hear freedom. They want social justice. They want all these things. But the one word that was most consistently there that wrapped it all up was dignity. And dignity, of course, is if you break it down, it means all these things. It means this relationship between them and the rulers, but it also means this relationship between them and the rest of the world. Because that sense that they didn't have the freedom wasn't just tied to to their domestic affairs. What they disliked the rulers over wasn't just because they didn't provide. They disliked them for that. But they disliked them because they didn't represent them honorably in the relations with the rest of the world. And so the foreign policy package can't be decoupled from the domestic policy package in their understanding of dignity. And that's why I think when you try to unpack their aspirations as these uprisings are unfolding, you find that even when people are trapped into a survival game internally, like in Egypt, where you have, you know, the Brotherhood and its opponents, and it's a zero-sum game, and it's ugly, and it's amazingly depressing in terms of the discourse and the demonization that takes place, or take Syria, the regime and its opponents, and how they all, of course, what they're obsessed with is their internal game for survival. It's not even, it's almost divorced from the rest of the world. They're not focused on America or Palestine or Israel as such. And yet, look at the discourse. The easiest thing for them to delegitimize the other side is to claim that they're working for agents of America or for Israel. Why is that? That's what people, I think, have to come to grips with, that this issue of identity and the struggle for dignity, yes, at the core is really daily life and their relationship within the system, but you can't decouple it from the relationship with the outside world.
Before we talk about what you call the prism of pain, I want to ask you, help our audience understand how they should look at these different countries. Is there a general conceptual way of thinking about how events will turn out in particular countries? I assume the strength of the regime, for example. What other things?
Yes. I'm really glad you asked about differentiating countries, because we're talking in generalities, and we do know that even on the issue of identity, by the way, there are differences. I'm talking about aggregately across the Arab world, the trends that I described. But even on identity, there are differences. For example, the Saudis have the weakest identification with the state. Only about 20% identify with the state first. In Lebanon, the strongest identification with the state, surprisingly, despite the sectarianism. In Egypt, the most balanced kind of identification between state Islam and Arabism. So they vary in that way. But I think as you look at the unfolding uprisings, because of what I said earlier, which is that the empowerment of the public means the empowerment of almost everyone, meaning, you know, along sectarian lines, class, ideology, everything. I think, therefore, the factors that are going to matter most are going to be the degree to which a state is heterogeneous or homogeneous, because obviously that's going to be a factor. We're witnessing the most troubled and armed struggles within the more heterogeneous countries. Take Syria and take Bahrain, where you have clashes across sects that are become bloodier. Second, the degree of the wealth of the country, it can buffer you. It doesn't protect you over time because people want freedom beyond money and the economy, but it can buffer you. We saw the Saudis, for example, announce huge multi-billion-dollar packages to essentially pacify the population. It can work for you for some time. Third, ideological divisions, even in countries where you don't have heterogeneity, sectarianism like Egypt and Tunisia, we see that deep divides between religious and secular is so strong that we saw what happened in Egypt. I think we're seeing a similar conflict at a lower level in Tunisia. We really feel that in Syria as well, layered over everything else, this sectarian the secular religious separate from the sectarian divide. By the way, similar in a way to the tension in Israel that drove the Israeli coalition. It was more secular religious than it was political overall. So these factors obviously will matter a lot for the degree to which these transitions are going to be relatively more peaceful or more bloody.
In addition to giving us an insightful understanding of the problem of identity and the transitions that are going on here, you also focus on what you call the prism of pain, the way the Arab vision is affected by its perceptions of outside intervention, the Arab-Israeli conflict. Help us understand why that is such a structural issue and so important in Arab eyes.
Well, you know, I think this issue is so misunderstood because I think people say, what do you mean the Arab-Israeli issue is important? Obviously, it's not important what's happening in Egypt or Syria or Tunisia. And they're right. A Tunisian woman doesn't wake up in the morning thinking, I'm thinking Israel or thinking America or thinking Palestine. They're thinking about getting food for their family, getting good schooling, jobs, daily life, routine. Like every person in the world, that's what they think about. And even if you resolve the Arab-Israeli issue tomorrow, that's not going to resolve the contention in Tunisia or, for that matter, in Syria or, for that matter, in any country in the Arab world. So in that sense, people who say it's not central, they're right. It's not the driving force. But what they don't understand is that while it isn't the driving force of politics in the Arab world, it is what I call the prism of pain, the subconscious and conscious one, through which Arabs evaluate the outside world and the intentions of the outside world, particularly the United States of America. Now, we've studied this, by the way, in the polling. And we can document the shifts that are mostly driven by this issue more than any other. When you ask people, name the one step that would matter most in improving your views of the U.S., by far this is issue number one. The second is the presence of American forces in the Gulf during the Iraq War. It was obviously the Iraq War, but not so much democracy giving economic aid or bringing peace and stability. When you ask people, what do you think drives American foreign policy in the Middle East, they mention oil and Israel, and everything else is secondary except for weakening the Muslim world. But very few people think it's advocacy of democracy or bringing about peace or helping economic welfare. So people don't have faith in America's intention beyond those two. So the question is why? Well, I'll give you three answers. Answer number one is in some ways related to one of the few successes of American foreign policy over the past decade, particularly after 9/11, when it's been an axiom of American foreign policy, you know, from the White House to members of Congress to American elites to Israeli politicians to say there is no space between the United States and Israel. And we shall allow no space between. Meaning what? Meaning that our position, Israel's position, identical. Of course, they're not, but we're projecting that. And by the way, that's the way Arabs have come to believe it. They see it as there's no space. So when they're angry with Israel, they're angry with the U.S. And if we look at the Arab discourse, it is very difficult to find the term Israel without America or the term America without Israel. They're kind of bound together now in some ways, the essential part. The second is, I think, a little bit more psychological, a little bit more complicated for people to grasp, which is while they, you know, people may not even know where Ramallah is, frankly, or may not know where Tel Aviv is on the map, or had it, you know, it's not that. This is an issue that has become a metaphor, for the Arab collective sense of humiliation in the relationship with the West, dating back almost to the beginning of the political system after World War I. And what makes it more central, beyond just a century of every Arab movement highlighting it as a core a part of that movement, is that in fact it has been consequential. Wars have taken place and had impact on almost every neighbor. And it has been an open wound where people are reminded of it every single day. And they're seemingly unable to do anything about it, and the rulers are seemingly unable to do about it, and it drives the point home to them that if the Arab uprising first and foremost about dignity, this issue represents dignity's antithesis to them. But there's a third issue, which I think is a little bit bigger. In an era when Arabs feel empowered, when they feel they need to achieve their right place in the world, where they want to assert their empowerment. And then you start with the following assumption. Start looking at it from the Israeli point of view. Put the Arabs aside for a moment. And Israel sees itself as a small country of 8 million people, actually only 6 million Jews. And it looks at the Arab world, and it sees 350 million Arabs. And it sees more Muslims in addition to that. And as long as there's no Arab-Israeli peace and there's no Palestinian-Israeli peace, the Israelis think that they have to make consideration for war because war is inevitable or likely or at least cannot be assumed not to take place. And in order for them to have this long-term strategic survival, they think that they have to have a strategy of domination strategically, meaning they have to have a technological advantages that would compensate, that would enable them to win against any combination of states, to have technology that is denied to the Arabs. And for that, they have the full support of the United States because the U.S. is the empower of Israel. And we say it as a doctrine, Israel shall have qualitative advantages over the Arabs. If you look at it from the Arab world point of view, and say, I'm 350 million empowered Arabs, and you're telling them they have to accept the strategic domination of a country of 8 million, very hard to swallow. And as long as the Arab-Israel issue is not resolved and Palestinian-Israel issue is not resolved, it's impossible to separate this issue psychologically or to think that Arabs would just accommodate themselves to Israel. And as long as they don't, they're not accommodating themselves with the U.S. because they see the two are tied together. So I think it's much bigger than people think. It's subconscious, even though people are not thinking about it every day. We see it in the way people select heroes. Give you the decade of before the Arab uprisings and after the Arab uprisings. In 2003, 2004, when we asked them, name the person you admire most, that was the time when we're speaking of a clash of civilization between the West and the East. And Arabs identify more than any other leader, Jacques Chirac of France. And you say, wait a second now, this is a country, you know, with imperial history and troubles with immigrants. And what's driving it? Well, Jacques Chirac hosted Yasser Arafat with dignity when he died after he'd been isolated in Ramallah by the Israelis and the Bush administration policy. And he was seen to have stood up to George W. Bush on the Iraq War. In 2006, 2007, we're talking about Sunni-Shia divide after the sectarianism of the Iraq War. That was the big theme of that period. And yet Sunni Arabs in Egypt, Morocco, and Jordan, they're identifying Hassan Nasrallah, the Shia leader of Hezbollah, as the man they admire most. Why? Because he was standing up to Israel. In 2009, you asked them about the person they admire most. It was the late Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, because he was the only one who had cut off relations with Israel over the Gaza War of 2008-2009. The following year was Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey, because of the so-called Turkish flotilla incident with Israel and his confrontation with Israeli leaders. So that is the issue through which they're making an evaluation of the outside world. Even in the middle of these uprisings, we found that to be true even 2011, 2012. So it is the prism of pain. It's not the only issue, obviously. And on a local level right now, if I'm a Syrian, that's a side issue for delegitimizing the opponent because I'm playing a survival game and I will align myself with the devil to survive if I can get the help, for sure, and with disregard to this issue. For sure, every environment has its moment. But across the board, this is tied to who Arabs are today.
So what does this structural problem tell us about what the U.S. can do policy-wise to change the perception? and have that change be enduring?
Well, here's what I'd say in the short term. There is nothing the U.S. can do in the short term in intervening a particular country, even for humanitarian reasons, that will be perceived as a transformative move that will compensate for the mistrust toward the U.S. that is based on its larger policies, namely toward the Israel-Palestine and the presence of American forces in the Gulf. Nothing. Doesn't mean the U.S. shouldn't do them for as a good in itself, such as humanitarian things. It's a separate issue. But it's not possible for the U.S. to transform. No matter what it does in Egypt, it's going to be blamed by both sides. If we had intervened in Syria over genuine humanitarian reasons to save lives, and even if we had succeeded, our aims will be seen as suspicious, and no one will thank you no matter what. So start with that, first of all. Second, I think that if you look at the Obama administration realism now, particularly after, 5 years of trying different approaches, and if you had heard the 2013 speech of President Obama at the UN General Assembly, which mapped out, in a way, a policy for the rest of his administration. It was a policy, obviously, that is based on much more pragmatism than in the past. But when he said, what am I going to do with the rest of the remaining? He didn't say I'm going to shape the outcome of Egypt. It was actually kind of a realism about Egypt. Well, we'll keep pushing for human rights, democracy when we can, but we have national security priorities. Same thing in some ways with Syria. He didn't make the chemical weapons an issue or Syria an issue. He said addressing the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and dealing with the Iranian nuclear issue. And the two are in some ways tied. That's good realism. Now, whether he's going to be able to do that or not, but really those are the big-ticket items that have to do with security in the Gulf and the Palestinian-Israel issue. And there's no avoiding that, because if you also bring into play the timing realism, namely that the solution advocated by the U.S., the two-state solution, Israel living side by side with the state of Palestine, the West Bank, and Gaza. Many people think it's no longer possible, and even those who think it still may be possible think it wouldn't be possible in very short order, maybe by the end of this administration. And therefore, the U.S. wouldn't even know what to do the next morning, because structurally you're locked into indefinite conflict over this issue without any even theoretical solution from the American point of view, because it's unlikely that the U.S. is going to suddenly advocate a one-state solution away from a Jewish state, which has been the American position. And so when you lock that in, I think you can understand why Obama has made this transition. Instead of reaching out, thinking that you can do outreach through speeches or through, are we going to give foreign aid? Are we going to help the democratic forces? Are we going to support civil society? All good. Don't dismiss it. But it's not transformative. It's not going to change the reality of the American relationship with the Middle East.
What is the Arab view of the Israel-Iranian conflict? An Arab person would say there's a struggle here for preeminence in the region. How do Arabs view that in the context of the Sunni-Shia split?
Fascinating story, because I think also this is not fully understood, because we have this simplistic assumption that it's all driven by a Sunni-Shia divide, when in fact that's an important divide. Don't dismiss it. It's important, particularly in countries where you have sectarianism, Lebanon, Iraq, Bahrain, for sure. But the forces behind Arab attitudes are far more complex than that. Now, let's differentiate public opinion from leaders, because governments have different calculations. The governments of the Gulf state are very much against Iranian expansion of power. Not so much, by the way, because of the nuclear issue. The nuclear issue isn't the central force, you know, it's just only a symbolic force about the empowerment of Iran. The Israelis may worry about the nuclear issue existentially, or say they do, but the Gulf countries don't think that way. They think about mostly the conventional power of Iran, the decline of Iraq as an Arab power standing up to Iran, the ability of Iran to reach into their Shia communities and empower them and bring about instability. That's the way they think about Iran, and they're anti-Iran, and that's a priority for them, particularly the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates. But for the Arab public, the Iran issue is far more complex. And I'll give you an example. Throughout the decade, when we asked, name the leaders that you admire most in the Arab world, while the Iranian leaders were never number one, Ahmadinejad would actually trump every single Sunni Arab leader in the Arab world throughout that whole decade, even when we're talking about Sunni-Shia divide in Sunni-majority countries. And when you ask them, do you want the international community to pressure Iran to limit its nuclear program, consistently in every country we had majorities say no, including, by the way, among Arab citizens of Israel itself. Think, you know, if you're worried about Iran using nuclear weapons against Israel, Arabs would be killed as much as Jews. That's not the issue. But what's driving it there is still an evaluation of Iran as a Muslim country that is at one level able to stand up to Israel and to the U.S., and people of two minds on it. On the one hand, they prefer an Arab power, but there isn't one. They think it's being singled out because it's a Muslim country, and they rally on that issue. If I were to conduct one in Egypt today, I would also see a different shift, because in Egypt, after the overthrow of Morsi, we don't know how pervasive it is, but we arguably a majority has become anti-Muslim Brotherhood. And with it, they become anti-Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. And while they don't like Assad, they like the Muslim Brotherhood less. And some of the conspiracy theories in Egypt of late were that the U.S. wanted to intervene in Syria to save the Muslim Brotherhood so that they come back to Egypt and save the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So you can see the complexity of the considerations that come into play here when Arabs make their express their views on Iran. It's not just about Sunni-Shia issue. It's not even the dominant issue most of the time. It might be for some of them for sure, particularly ultra-religious Sunnis and some segments of the public in the Gulf, but that's not the pervasive consideration across the Arab world.
Well, Shibli, thank you very much. But let me show your book one more time. I think people will want to go out and buy it, because there's a limit to what we can cover in an hour. But this was a very informative discussion. Thank you for coming back to Berkeley to discuss your new book.
Thank you for hosting me. Always good to be here.
Thank you, and thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.